And we're back. The Breakfast Club.
Mm-mm. No.
It's not it better be the club. Other Breakfast Club. I am Allie motherfucking Sheedy.
Okay. Well, yeah, I have... Is James Spader in that movie?
Nope.
He should have been, though.
Yeah.
I know, right?
He would have been really hot. No, you would be the... Not Anthony Michael Hall. Mm. As a bully, to me, you're the Judd Nelson. But
Okay. I was confusing James Spader with Judd Nelson, and... Forgive me.
Yeah, please. Please don't mix up former Suddenly Susan cast members again.
No, I'm talking about The Breakfast Club because there was a wild interview.
On The Breakfast Club?
Yes.
With Charlamagne?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes, with Elizabeth Warren.
I know.
Yeah.
Liz, who booked this?
Here's a thing I want to say. I feel like I'm already jumping into the keep its. I get that the Democratic... You know, candidates want to go where they can be seen. You know, they love sitting down, love talking into a mic. Do that with Jon Favreau, you know? He's talking to Oprah's spiritual advisor on shows.
Oh, yeah, Marianne Williamson.
Yeah, for some reason. But don't go on The Breakfast Club. Don't sit down and talk to Charlamagne.
I just had a conversation with someone about this because it's clearly... It is when the white candidates are like, look at us, we, youths of color, we're down. And like, first of all, I'm going to tell you something. That block of people probably isn't voting for any of you.
Yeah.
Like you're not going on The Breakfast Club and like someone's like, oh, I listen to Charlamagne regularly. I've changed my mind on Elizabeth Warren. I wouldn't worry about that. I would go fucking register some voters in places where Republicans are not letting black people vote. Like, that's going to do more for what I assume your goal with that is.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, what astute political insights are you going to be able to work through with Charlamagne?
Absolutely none. And I also put the blame on people like Bill Maher, Ari Melber. These are the white men who constantly pretend as if Charlamagne is smart. And should be giving commentary on other TV shows. And so now we have this warped sense of the idea that Charlamagne is a person that you should go to.
Like he's part of the rounds.
Yeah.
Bill Maher really is the king of finding people with nothing good to say fascinating. wasn't he like propping up Milo Yiannopoulos for all those
years?
They're
friends.
Yeah.
Ann Coulter.
Right, Ann Coulter, our girl.
So stay off Bill Maher and stay on the fucking Breakfast Club. Stay off the Breakfast Club.
It really felt like that entire thing was him building up to a joke he had pre-written about Rachel Dolezal.
Yes, he was already in his mind like, I'm going to call Elizabeth Warren the original Rachel Dolezal.
Which is just leaning into a narrative that Trump built. And by the way, he's like the biggest racist of all. So don't follow that line.
Also, like, my God, people, it feels like as every time we get close to being done with fucking Rachel Dolezal, one of you morons says her name again. And then now the name was trending on Twitter again. I'm like, you're only helping this fool.
Well, I said her name 3 times in a mirror this morning, Kara. So she may
appear?
Be our guest this episode.
What if I say Iggy Azalea just had a new single? It was featuring Rachel Dolezal. What would you do?
I would not be shocked. Also, it was trash because I digged up this old interview where Charlamagne was comparing Rachel Dolezal to Caitlyn Jenner.
Oh, good.
And so he's not even, you know, on the side of coming down on Rachel Dolezal.
Right.
So it means that everything that he was doing with Elizabeth Warren was just so it would trend and people would talk about it.
Fun fact, Charlamagne once wrote me an email when I was a writer at Jezebel, because he had given an interview with Dasha Palermo and didn't seem to be familiar with the concept of Afro-Latinas, despite living in New York fucking city, where most of them are. And and then he wrote me an email like, I really didn't know. I was like, okay. That was like the crux of the email.
You could fill a book or a whole podcast episode with things Charlamagne doesn't know. Anyway.
Oh, the things you don't know.
I know, right? Anyway, he's dumb. His show was dumb. He's transphobic. Don't go on his show.
Yeah.
Don't go on his show. Anyway, today We have a lot going on.
That's true.
Yeah, if we got
legends.
All, yes, we have legends.
Controversially, we stand legends on this podcast.
We do. Well, we have legends, icons, stars. It's an entire episode of Pose today. we're just throwing a ball. But we'll be joined by author Jacob Tobia, and we will be talking about their new book, Sissy, and also the over-commercialization of Pride. As
Ira sits in a Pride polo hoodie. Yeah. By the way,
you know,
looking at the problem,
because you know,
all the proceeds went to the Stonewall Foundation. So I'm happy
you did it.
I didn't pay for it. We will also be joined by icon, TV icon, Dechina Arnold, TV icon, life icon,
side eye icon.
Yes.
And what a performance she gives in this new movie.
Dechina Arnold will be here to talk with us about her new film, The Last Black Man in San Francisco. Was not aware there were any.
There's just the one.
This is a newsreel. Yes.
Just the one in the movie. And then we're going to talk about Kanye West on David Letterman's Netflix show. And won't that be fun?
I'll be here.
We'll be right back. It's June, which means that finally...
It's busting out all over, Leslie Uggam style.
Well, I mean, finally... Dark Phoenix is out.
Oh, thank God.
I don't know. Maybe.
Jean Grey is going to do it this time.
Sansa is ready.
What are you talking about?
The new X-Men movie.
The new X-Men movie.
Oh.
You've heard of Dark Phoenix, Kara. There's been 17 versions of this movie that have come out in the past 10 years. But June also means that it's the beginning of Pride Month. And this year, we're also celebrating the 50th anniversary of Stonewall. And as a refresher course, the Stonewall riots were a series of violent demonstrations. People died for our rights, Lewis.
Oh, yeah. I love that clip of Derek Barry and Willem. Nobody died at Stonewall, guys, but yeah.
Nobody died? But it was a series of protests led by members of the LGBTQ community, predominantly people of color, against a police raid that took place at Stonewall Inn in New York in 1969. And the events are widely recognized as the beginning of the modern fight for LGBTQ rights in the U.S. So to talk about... Pride and everything surrounding our culture. I don't know. We're just going to go for it. Jacob Tobia is here.
Hi.
Hello, author of Sissy, A Coming of Gender Story, a book which you
should all author.
Ooh.
Yes.
Oh, gotta put that in there.
Oh.
It's officially national bestseller.
So all right.
Just.
You earned that.
You did earn that.
I really did, though. It was through chaos and witchcraft, but I earned it.
Also, I mean, the witchcraft in the blazer Jacob is wearing is very important. It belongs on an actress who is exactly like a Mare Winningham or something.
Yes.
Somebody who's like seventh build, but cool. You know?
Catherine Hahn.
Sure. Oh, sure. Catherine Hahn would love that blazer.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Catherine Hahn.
Yes.
She's really having an upswing right now.
She's been having an upswing since forever.
She's like fourth build now.
Yeah, quite.
Yeah.
Yes.
And she will get to first. If she has to shove someone down the stairs. She's seen Showgirls. Anyway, Jada.
I would support Catherine Hahn if she shoves someone down the stairs.
Yeah.
I wouldn't ask any questions. I'd be like, okay.
I just hope she's not replacing the memory of Anna Gasteyer. They sort of have similar spaces in my brain. Anyway, I'm concerned.
All right, so we're here. Why do we think Pride Month is still important? Is it important?
Well, I mean, it's like, you know, in some ways, the joke I make often is I'm like, it's gay Christmas now. You know what I mean? Right? Like, and I say that as someone who grew up in the Methodist church. So with the full weight of like, you know, I feel like when I was like, like a teenager or whatever, you know, there'd be like, it's about we have to talk about the true meaning of Christmas. We can't get distracted by the corporatization of Christmas. It's about our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, being born in a little manger with the hay and the wood thing and the animals and the star and the shepherds and whatever. You know, like there was like this whole kind of like, don't get distracted about the true meaning of the thing. Don't let the companies distract you from it. And I feel like now I'm like a pastor, but around Pride, I'm just like, don't get distracted from the true meaning of Pride, the true reason for the season. And it's Marsha P. Johnson. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, and so
don't get distracted by that free Chipotle gift card that they throw from the float.
I love that gift card. I love that gift card.
So do I.
I need that gift card. Yes.
I definitely, I feel like there was one year where somehow I got like 10 of them.
Yes, there was definitely that. I feel like it was 3 or 4 years ago, Chipotle was really going overboard
it was,
with those
I think
gift
three
cards.
Or four, yeah.
And you just see friends with like, I've got 7.
Yeah, no, I ate free
Gloria
Chipotle.
Gloria Allred's
like,
throwing them at you. Yeah.
It was like, it wasn't just in June. Like, I ate free Chipotle like all the way till September, you know, like once a week for like it was incredible. I used to work right next to Chipotle, like shout out Chipotle. Thank you for fueling my activism along with other issues. But yeah, I mean, I think it's like, you know, there's one way to look at it that is sort of like the cynics, like, oh my gosh, like all these companies are just trying to market to like mm-hmm. queer folks that have expendable income and blah, 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 blah. And I think in some ways that's an oversimplification, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's because the thing I always try and remind myself is that behind almost every pride initiative at a company, it's like there's sort of two things going on, right? There's always like at some point, generally there's like that like cis straight executive who had to be convinced that they could do this. Mm-hmm. But almost always the person fighting for that to happen, like at the company, is like some wonderful queen, some like mm-hmm. really brilliant dyke. Like, I don't know, but it's like, it's someone queer in the company who is like, yeah. let's do something cool for like our thing, mm-hmm. you know? And so I try and honor that even at its kind of most corporate and annoying, it is actually still generally the creative labor of like queer and trans folks who are working within these institutions to sort of bring more visibility around the season. That being said, there are definitely better and worse ways to do it.
Correct.
You know what I mean?
You also actually just keyed into what my favorite thing about a Pride Parade is, which is obviously there's like lots of different ways to be visible in a Pride Parade, et cetera. But weirdly, something I love the most is seeing where gay people or queer people work. You know what I mean? Like right. that to me is like an illustration of entire life. Like I get to be myself because I can pay for it via this job. Sometimes it's like a giant corporation you probably hate, but other times it's not. You know, it's like interesting to see like, this is what's coming to mind. The LA Zoo. Represented at Pride.
Right, because I feel like as gay people, so many, especially like in LA, like right. so many people like used to look at their Instagram, you're like, are you an Instagram model? Is this what you do all day? And right. then at Pride, you see them walking in like, you know, their technical institute that they're like a professor at.
Yeah,
or
right.
something. It's like, oh, you have a real job.
And you just happen to have those abs. Fuck.
It also, I feel like I wonder what people expect also from corporations. Like, you're saying right. corporations are hypocritical. Like, I just saw an ad from Nike where it was like about women being strong, and we just found out that they like stopped paying female athletes when they got pregnant.
Wait,
so,
really?
Like, the disconnect Ew. Between. It's a fucking company.
Right.
And so I don't find the disconnect to be surprising. And right. like whether or not you have legitimate gripes with it, it's sort of like, guys, what hasn't been commercialized by these people? Like anything, any cash grab they can take.
Right.
And so it's one of those where it's like, it's not, it was inevitable. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like you were mm-hmm. never going to not get to a point where this was something that they were all trying to just like, make money off
being
of.
Gay yeah. as a company anyway. I mean, Alexis Carrington owns 51% of it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. What's more humanizing than being objectified by a brand?
Right. It's right. just
I feel alive.
I never yeah. feel more empowered than yes. when I have to sell something for somebody.
Yeah, that's right.
You do at least like when the brand, you know, sort of
yeah.
donates, you know, 100% even, you know.
Right. No, and like that's you know? The kind of thing, like, I mean, like I did two like brand related pride things mm-hmm. this year. And one of them is with Fossil Watches, and they're donating 100% of proceeds from this watch that they designed mm-hmm. to the Hedrick Martin Institute, which is an organization that I fucking love mm-hmm. That does like super vital work in New York and New Jersey for like, you know, economically marginal like LGBTQ youth. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, you know, like that 100% number is really important to me when mm-hmm. thinking about mm-hmm. these partnerships because it's kind of like, yeah, like, but actually, if you're going to, like, make money off of the feel-good of the season, you need to, like, do some feel-good.
Right, yeah. because and the 50% right. feels like, you're fine with, like, a 50%, but it feels a little cheap sometimes because right. it's like, use this to market your product then.
Exactly.
You know, give away all those profits that you make from whatever it is that you're pimping out and then hope that people remember your product fondly when Pride right. is over and you go back to your boring colors.
And also, like, design cute shit.
Yes.
Sometimes right. the stuff that people make is atrocious.
Do you think it's an argument? Do you think there's, or how do you feel about the argument that, like, oh, look, there's a rainbow flag on everything. Like, you got, like, it has, in joining that sort of club of commoditizing Pride, that it signals to, like, an acceptance in some way. Just I feel like some people are like, oh, look, it's happened to you too, just like it's happened to all of these other things. And doesn't that signal that, like, just get in line, like all these other things that started out as something a bit more important, but, you know, we've now turned into just Disneyland.
Right. And I think that's the thing is, like, I would like ultimately to resist the Disneylandification of pride and sort of get beyond, because I think it's also like, just because pride has been kind of like latched onto in a pretty corporate way doesn't mean that like all sort of organizations honoring pride are created equal, right? Like, I think that it is incumbent on us as like a queer community to stay just as critical as we should always be, and in some ways also be maybe become critical in ways that we aren't on a day-to-day. You know, like, I remember, I feel like I saw some tweet or something from, like, the FBI being like, happy FBI Pride. And I was like, this is dystopia.
The FBI is out here tweeting, like, we're honoring Martin Luther King. And I was like, you all, like, give me a break.
Like, give us a fucking break.
Yeah.
Like,
my favorite Pride film, J. Edgar.
Yeah.
No, and like, I mean, yeah, like, obviously, if they had tweeted, right, like, if they had been like, today we're celebrating, like, you know, our, like, weird sort of, like, low-key dictator, like, gender non-conforming icon, cross-dressing fucking revolution, J. Edgar Hoover, then we'd be like, okay, we can at least talk about, like, you shouldn't honor him, probably, but, like, we can talk about, like, it's cool that the FBI is acknowledging that the dude, you know, was, like, unfortunately, part of like the gender nonconforming and queer community.
As Kamala Harris would say, we can have that conversation.
Right.
I want to know, actually, pivoting from the Disneylandification of pride, this sort of idea of, I feel like as queer people, especially when you're younger and you're sort of coming out, right? A large part of a pride is about finding a community that will accept you, seeing just sort of a celebration of who you are. And a lot of people's journeys involve, oh, I can bring my parents to this, you know, and like they can like show that they support me. But I also wonder how you think that like jives with the idea of a lot of queer people feeling like we shouldn't force pride to be family friendly, you know, like, you know, it's things where it's like some people are like, I don't know if I want to take my kids to pride, you know, because like you see people from like the fetish community or other things like happening and floats and stuff that they think wouldn't be family friendly. But I'm like, that's also part of the community too. So how do we like have this balance of something that we can educate family and like kids with, but also something that still celebrates the fullness of what queer life is?
Well, I think we have to sort of revisit what our core assumptions are about what it means to be family friendly. Because when you think when people say, oh, like you, like, for example, like don't have a kinky puppy, you know, like walking around at Pride because that's going to be too much for my children and it's not family friendly. And I'm like, well, the part of the family that that's not friendly towards is not the children. It's the uncomfortable squirming parents.
Yeah.
Right. Uh-huh. Like actually kids, I don't think that sex positivity really like it's not bad for kids. You know what I mean? Like when kids are going to a pride parade, if they see someone dressed up in some kinky leather, they're not going to be like, oh, kink. They're going to be like, oh, that's a funny outfit. I like that outfit.
Right,
like, it's not even sexual for kids. Yeah. You know what I mean?
And I wasn't turned on by him from Powerpuff Girls.
Right. Speak for yourself. But like,
yeah, wow.
But I found that more my teenage years. I was like, ooh, wow. Like, is this like the power dom I need or is this the power dom I am? I don't know. But no, I just, the idea that like, oh, like, children should not see like naked people running around. Like, that's bad for them. I mean, like, I'm not saying bring your children to Folsom Street Fair. You know what I mean? But like, if you're just like parading and you're like in your kink garb or you're parading in like, you know, not dressed very much, like, it's like literally, like, a child is not going to be scarred by seeing a gay boy in a thong. Well, they're going to be like, that's fun.
The other thing is, if your kids see something they have not seen before, they're children, they're new to the world, they're going to ask you what's going on, and parents don't want to have to explain shit because either they're lazy or they don't want to do the work of, like, it's just, because there's an easy explanation for a lot of things. It's like, they're being who they are, whatever it is.
Right.
But, like, people don't want to have to do the work of, like, hey, by the way, there are people unlike us in the world, and they're cool, too, kids.
And it's also, we're really bad at, like, talking. We're really bad at, like, explaining basic like things around sex to children,
right.
You know, in ways that are non-sexual, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's actually really easy. Like, if your child, just like PSA, if your child sees like, you know, a kinky puppy or like, you know, like a leather daddy or whatever, and they're like, what's that outfit? Then you can just be like, oh, well, he, like, some people have fun wearing that.
Yeah.
It's just, right. he's having fun. Isn't yeah. that fun?
Right. Because that's a lot of what your book talks about too.
Right.
You know, I think that I really love the part where you talk about how you want newer, messier narratives just for queer people, you know, because you talk about, you know, as a non-binary person, just the idea that your story, for instance, isn't Laverne Cox's or, you know, or Janet Mock's, you know, it's like, it's different. It's not what you're even going to see on like Pose or something, you know, it's, you are
it's
giving.
It's what we should see more of on
yes.
Pose. And will, I'm sure.
Yeah. <In time. laughs> And so I like that idea of just sort of like, pride is what it is for people, you know? And so, yeah. you know, you have to figure out how to talk about it yourself.
And also this idea that like, that kids can't handle queer concepts. It's like the irony is that actually the thing that's generally really confusing for children is like hatred. Kids are really confused when you tell them to hate somebody. But kids are actually really chill with like the idea of like, oh, people just are different ways.
Right.
You know, like, people, you know, I feel like one of the big kind of stereotypes or stigmas that's out there about kind of like non-binary or gender non-conforming people and the trans community and stuff is like, well, how do I explain all this to my children? It's too complicated for them. And I'm like, no, actually gender, like gender diversity and like gender spectrum sort of thinking is like what naturally comes to children. Have you ever met a child?
Yeah.
Like they don't think in two rigid binary genders. Like that behavior is actually deeply confusing. Like the gender binary is so much work to teach kids. Holy shit, the amount of time we spend teaching kids the gender binary. We literally are like spend like 10 whole years being like, no, this is how gender works. No, it's one of two. No, you messed it up again, Timmy.
Buy this toy and dress this way. Yeah.
Right. Like that's so confusing for kids to be like, wait, no, pink is a color that you can't wear. Wait, but why? What the fuck? That doesn't make any sense. Whereas like, oh, some people wear this thing. Some people wear that thing. People wear things that make them happy.
Yeah, the
that's
easiest
simple,
reference
yeah.
is probably just remembering, like, when you're a kid and you like the Power Rangers or something.
Right.
You know, you pick whatever color you like and you want to be that person. But at some point, an adult tells you, no, you can't be Kimberly.
Right,
or
right.
Right.
You know.
Also, I just think it's a weirdly underrated hard part of coming out, speaking for myself, I guess. To me, the hardest part of coming out, I mean, look, there's obviously it's like, who's out there that's going to be horrible to me, et cetera, et cetera. But honestly, to me, the hardest thing is realizing how much straight people have not prepared you for it. Like, how can't
right.
you, like, why did you not, like, teach me any of this? And it goes back to this conversation of, for some reason, you're pretending I couldn't handle it. And now I'm out here by myself having to figure it out,
right.
you know?
And in fact, what I couldn't handle was, like, the overwhelming cruelty that the world expressed to me anytime I was feminine. Yeah. Right? I was like, I couldn't handle that shit. But if you just been like, some people are girlier, some people are more masculine, some people like enjoy pink, some people don't, some people are extra and have too much gender and are really annoying to everybody else around them because they keep trying to steal all the fucking tool and all the tutus and they don't know how to share very well at dress up time, Jacob. But you know, it's natural. And I would have been like, okay, great. And so, I guess when I think about like kids at Pride and kids and queer ideas and all that stuff, I'm just like, no. Like the goal should be to like end up raising our kids queer, you know? And if they end up not being queer or trans, that's fine. But like, let's assume that every child on this planet is queer and trans. And what would we how would we build a world like designed for their empathy? And kindness towards them, you know? And that world is one where, like, you wear whatever you want to Pride because we actually, like, have really great conversations around, like, consent and, like, touching and all those kinds of things with our kids and be like, hey, you know, like, there is such a good, like, if you don't like how someone's touching you, you let me know kind of shit. You know, like, there's basic protective conversations we don't even have with kids around, like, what it means to keep kids safe. And keeping kids safe, you can't keep kids safe with sex negativity. You have to. Yeah. You can only keep kids safe by being honest about like what goes on in the world at an age appropriate level. I'm not a child psychologist, but maybe this is like another calling for
I
my
see
life.
It.
There's also nothing I hate more than people rolling up to some shit that they're not a part of and then demanding things be different. Like in any arena, like you don't get to show up to this thing and like, no, but I'd rather the hors d'oeuvres be. Bitch, what? You weren't. This isn't. This wasn't
your
thing.
Did you pay for those
hors d'oeuvres? Yeah, exactly. Like,
yeah, I have no pitches for Sweet Heat in Miami for like Black Lesbian Pride.
You're a fucking guest here, man. This is what we're serving, and that's what's happening.
Well, and also, like, if you're a queer parent with children and you can't figure out some sort of age appropriate way to explain why some people dress up like puppies, then like, you know, God help you.
Yeah,
you know, being a queer parent's tough anyway. So it's like, yeah, I commiserate a little bit, but it's like, this is possible and not that hard. And also, like, don't act like thongs are that scary.
Right. Yeah.
And Scooby you know? Taught us for years that you just dress up as things to haunt people out of places.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's why we dress
you
up as
linger.
Pride.
Yeah.
We want to scare straight people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's actually
out
a,
of our neighborhood.
Yeah, we're gonna militarize our feathers.
Yeah. Jacob, I want to thank you for being here.
Of course,
and of course, the book is Sissy,
one of the great words,
mm-hmm. a bestseller.
Yeah,
the book is great. People should get it. It tells your story, and I think it will help other people with their stories.
I sure hope so. Because the whole thing point is that everyone has a coming of gender story to tell, you know? Like the book itself is a bait and switch. It's like, yes, come read about my journey with gender. And then by the end you're like, oh fuck, what do I know about my own gender? And I'm like, gotcha. So if you would enjoy that experience and want to go on that journey with me, buy the book.
The trickery jumped out.
When we're back, we'll be talking to Tichina Arnold about her latest film, The Last Black Man in San Francisco. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of blackness from NPR and how I live my life every day.
Oh, I'm glad to bear witness to it.
Each of NPR's black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of a struggle.
It sounds like you at Coachella. I'm already tuned in. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be black today, told from a unique black perspective, from Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations. There's no limit to the range of black stories, black truths.
Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as varied, nuanced, and black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us without us.
Doesn't the black experience sound like a 3-disc Prince album we never got? Someone check the vault, please. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR wherever you get your podcasts.
We are back with actress, TV legend, icon.
Oh, gosh.
Tichina Arnold.
Thank you. Hi.
I am so happy you are here.
Thank you. Yes. I'm happy to be here. This is awesome. In this nice big building with quiet people. We all sit around at the round table. All I need is a goddamn glass of wine and we're good.
Listen, we wish we had the wine too.
I want to say, she came in, it was like quiet as a study out there. And she goes, I don't mean to disturb anybody. It was legendary.
I didn't know they were like right around there. The
That was funny.
There's so much we could talk about with you.
God.
I mean, because you've done it all. Truly.
I tried to.
You know, I mean, I think most people will know Martin, which was iconic. It's one of my favorite sitcoms. And you did such a great job of just, you know, being the comic relief, you know, really sort of competing with Martin Lawrence, you know?
He's crazy, but...
Right, which is hard to do on that show because he's also playing so many characters, too. But I think that, like, you were consistently one of the funniest parts of that show.
What I loved about being on Martin, we didn't know what we had. We really didn't. We literally came to work and we freaking laughed our asses off every day. We came to work and we fed off each other. It wasn't until Martin hit syndication and this little Indian boy walks up to me and he's like, "You are Bam!" And I was like, "Oh my God, we've reached."
Yeah,
we like because we didn't know. Like Martin was his comedic ability is infectious. Mm-hmm. And either you're going to be on board or you're not. And I always say and give him accolades for making me a better comedic actress because mm-hmm. you never knew what he was going to do. Mm-hmm. So you just had to stay with him. He would never stick to the script, which was a lot of fun. So Martin, literally, the show was created as it played out.
How do you feel now, you know, with the internet and like streaming services and things like that, like this new audience of people that are discovering the show? Because I feel like it's something, especially with millennials, like we were of an age where you, like, I remember watching it live, but mm-hmm. then rewatching it, and like I'm older now, so I get it a little bit more. And just like the idea that the show has like followed you in that way.
It's weird seeing the influence that Martin has had on, like, my daughter. She's 15 now, 15 going on 55. Please pray for me. when she was 8, because we used to watch Family Guy together, and I used to tell her, don't let people know that you watch Family Guy. Because, you know, she got it. She got comedy. Like, she was laughing at the same jokes. Yeah. I was like, oh, my God, my kid gets comedy. Thank God. So one day she was in her room all day, and I'm like, Elijah, what are you doing? She comes out. She's like, Mom, I just finished watching Martin. And she goes, you were really funny. I was like, I told you I was funny. But it's amazing to see what impression that we've made upon mm-hmm. the millennials because they've been watched. Like, I kind of act like Lily Tomlin, Carol Burnett, mm-hmm. you know, my boy, Flip Wilson. Mm-hmm. Those are the people that I watched. Mm-hmm. But it's weird watching people who watched us
uh-huh. yeah.
mm-hmm. act like us. It's the craziest thing. It's yeah. the weirdest thing. So the millennials and this new age mm-hmm. of people that are on the internet yeah. and they're, you know, being funny and doing things, I think it's a blessing, you know. Mm-hmm. Comedy lives forever, and I think it's important to make people laugh. I mm-hmm. think it's important for us to tell stories. I think it's important for us to be honest with each other. But to see the effects of what mm-hmm. Martin has done throughout the 20-something years that it's been out, it's just crazy.
I was going to say, your performance in The Last Black Man in San Francisco illustrates just how versatile you are. It's such a fabulous performance. Oh, you do such fabulous work.
Thank you.
Right, A24 is a new movie, Last Man in San Francisco.
Yes. Plan B.
Last Black Man in San Francisco.
What did he say?
He said last man.
Okay. But you know what? Every man could watch this and relate to it.
Yeah.
Because there's white men in this movie that, you know, it doesn't make the white man the bad man. Mm-hmm. It just shows an honest reflection of what happened.
I mean, they are villainous.
Yeah. But, you know. Yeah.
And this movie is wonderful. I have one more question about like your sitcom past. Clearly, you can do anything, but do you actually miss the era of like completely whiz-bang comedy on
yes.
TV? I do feel like it's like diminished in a way. I'm like, we're a little bit obsessed with realism
yeah.
in a way that is just like we miss the gigantic comic moments nowadays.
That is such a good, poignant point because I do miss it. And it's hard to convey missing it without hating on what's happening now.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I kind of like try to, you know, parse my words and just kind of, you know, use my words carefully in describing the difference between then and now, because I don't want to be, you know, I'm turning 50 this month and I'm like, I don't want to be that lady like, oh, I remember the good old days. But they were good old days. The 90s were sick.
Yes.
The 90s were so much fun. And it was just a whole era of just newness. Everything mm-hmm. was new. Everything was, I mean, nothing new is new on this earth, but it felt new. Everything was innovative. It was just, it came from a real place. So now you have, you know, the industry now trying to create the real. And you can't create real.
Yeah.
That's what your problem is.
Did you feel that push and pull, I guess, when you were on Everybody Hates Chris? Because that was sort of that bridge, I feel mm-hmm. like, between the 90s comedy and switching to sort of like what we do now in comedy. But I felt that you were very grounded in that show, but also there were great moments where you still were able to give us like exaggerated character.
I always say thank God for flashbacks. Yeah, the flashbacks. Yeah. You know, Ali LaRoy and Chris Rock did an amazing job with Everybody Hates Chris because I always attribute that part of my life to, you know, is when I had my daughter. She was two. So I was a new mother. So, and it was the first time I was ever playing a mother. Mm-hmm. And so for me to play a mother and still be able to be funny, mm-hmm. still be able to convey funny stories, still be able to be a Black woman and mm-hmm. be proud of it and not compromise my Blackhood, my Black womanhood, mm-hmm. on top of telling somebody's story that's not really literally their story, but it's through the eyes of Chris Rock, who's a comedic, brilliant guy as well. Just to be able to be a part of that project, it really taught me a lot. It stepped my game up because now it's not four cameras that are on me. It's two cameras. It's single cameras, completely mm-hmm. different from multi-camera. Mm-hmm. So I had to pull back. It's like, oh, okay, not so big. Mm-hmm. But then those moments where we do the flashbacks, I mm-hmm. can go big. But to be able to have different levels of my career, I want to do it all. Well, I want to do it all.
You talked about, like, when you're talking about the 90s, a narrative that I see a lot now is, like, we need, like this sort of push in diversity as if it's new, as if there were not, in particular, if we're talking about Black women, tons of Black girls on TV in the mm-hmm. 90s, because that was, like, what I watched, and I remember how many, like, shades and how many different types of Black girls. There were a lot of them, so they went away, and so this thing now is not this new thing of putting these people on television. It's like, well, you need to get back to some shit that you had started that went away. Mm-hmm. And I know you said, like, that you want to play, like, white girl roles.
Yeah.
See,
black is the new black.
Yeah.
You know, we're in the era of Black is the new black. Mm-hmm. And for me to be able to have the opportunity, because it's a two-sided coin here. It's you have very rarely do, like, Last Black Man in San Francisco was the first script that was written for a Black woman. Mm-hmm. That I saw a role that's written for, it didn't say all ethnicity. Mm-hmm. And I auditioned like everybody else for it. So when I read the scene, I was like, oh, my God, I got to do this. I didn't even understand all of the film because that's how poetic this film is. It was hard to visualize. It was hard for my imagination to see how the DP and the director, Joel Talbot, amazing. Adam Newport, yes, amazing DP. But to be able to convey a story that is a real story, a true story, a story about Black men and being seen in a different light that they haven't been seen before, to be able to have a script that was written for me. Mm-hmm. You know, it becomes personal. Yeah. And now it becomes something that I want to do and be a part of because it's part of the story of my legacy. It's a part of the story of a legacy in the arts, period. So we have situations where, as a Black woman in America, I'm not afforded the same opportunities. I'm not afforded the same things. Mm-hmm. We can't cry about it. So we got to take what we got and do what we can with it. And this film, have you guys seen it?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. Okay. You're seen with Jimmy. You
well, felt I mean, like my one aunt. Word, one word, yeah. One word. Tell me how you felt about that. Describe the film and how you felt after you left. One word.
I mean, I'm going to choose a word you chose, which is poetic.
Okay, one word.
Stirred.
Wow, yeah. Great word.
Expansive.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Look at that.
It's crazy. Mm-hmm. So we don't get projects like this enough. Mm-hmm. I think Hollywood needs more projects.
What's a role, a white girl role, that you wish you had gotten to play?
Oh,
like,
gosh.
Just throughout?
Oh, yeah, it was on the white girl thing. The reason why I like going out for white girl roles because Black women, we do everything. We're not just one thing.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, because Black is the new Black now, mm-hmm. we're discovering, oh, hey, Black people know how, oh, y'all know how to do that. Like, we're skateboarders. We're surfers. You know what I mean?
I know specifically which white girl role I wish you had played.
What?
They know where I'm about to go. I'm a big soap opera fan. So
okay.
I still watch Days of Our Lives to this day.
Oh, wow.
Everyone who listens to the show knows that. Grew up on them. You were on Ryan's Hope.
Yes.
You played Zena Brown.
Yes, I sure did.
And you were basically just the black best friend who came to the door every day and were helping this girl, Emily Ann.
Who was
crying all the fucking time.
Yeah.
Because she found out her mom was a prostitute. Her real dad was the pimp. She had a breakdown, went to an institution. Watching those clips, it's just like, I wish that was you. And I wonder, like, how you felt, because you were born in Queens.
Yep, Jamaica, Queens.
You know, joining Ryan's Hope, this show, you know, about this Irish Catholic family, and sort of being the best friend. I mean, and it's one of your first roles, too. So, like, were you, how did you feel on that set? Were you like, damn, I wish, like, I could mix it up in a story?
I wish my mom was a prostitute.
I wish my mom. But you know where I was during that time? I was literally, when I did Ryan's Hope, I was 17 going on 18. Mm-hmm. And I was overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. I was scared. I was happy because very rarely do you get a dark-skinned black woman on soap operas with crooked teeth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So I defied a lot of odds.
Yeah.
I did. So just the fact of me being there, I was just one of those, I'm happy to be here.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until probably after the first, because there's not really seasons because it goes on and on.
Well, you did get a daytime Emmy nomination.
Yes, I did. I got a daytime
for Best Ingenue.
Yes, you won it. Yes. But to be there, I wanted to take whatever they gave me and just make it happen or make it. So I'm always used to being, sad to say, second fiddle.
Mm-hmm.
But it's okay to be second fiddle sometimes because the second fiddle holds the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the second fiddle holds the storyline. But for me to be able to be amongst those people that have been there forever, because I was on the last 2 years and it went off the air.
And then you joined All My Children,
So Felicia Bear took me with her to All My Children, which was a blessing. So that soap opera world is a whole different beast. Mm-hmm. I learned everything what not to do on soap operas.
Mm-hmm.
I never read from the teleprompters. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, this is the weak spot for actors because they're looking at that damn teleprompter. But I understand. I don't judge actors that do it because you're learning four scripts in one day. So it was a very challenging time for me, but it was a make or break time for me being on soap operas because it was just a different beast.
And you were early in those days too. It was before like Generations on NBC.
Generation.
Before you had Victoria Ryle join Young and the Restless and stuff. So you were there before.
Angie.
Yeah, and Angie Hubbard, too.
Debbie Morgan. We love Debbie Morgan.
Yeah.
She, all we need is one. She opened that door, and, you know, she created a door for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I just always want to be able to use whatever opportunity that I get and use it wisely. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite peer that you like watching? I feel like you must have come up with like a bunch of actresses you just fucking love.
Oh my God. Well, you know, I have so many. I'm good friends with Tisha Campbell, of course, with Gina King, Gabrielle Union, Jada Pinkett. Like, it's weird seeing my peers. We're all doing our own thing, but it's like, yeah, I knew this bitch when she was sleeping on my damn couch. I don't even, you know what I'm saying? So to see. To see everybody elevate to a place where we all talked about this. We all dreamt the same dreams. We all aspired for the same things. And we were all in competition with each other as well in the midst of it. For us to come out of it and see the fruits of our labor, it's just amazing. It's amazing to watch. But I do. I like a lot. I don't watch myself. I watch other people. Like, I probably haven't seen a full episode of Martin in like 20 years.
You know who
I don't watch myself.
I would have wanted to seen you as maybe Nurse Jackie.
Oh, wow.
I can see that.
Now, that role is an amazing role. See, and these are the roles that I like going out for. Did I audition for Nurse Jackie?
If you want to audition for Nurse Jackie, like, the reboot right now, go right out.
But you see your desire to see black women and not just, because we have to be a part of telling our own stories, which Last Black Man in San Francisco does.
Mm-hmm.
You have Joel Talbot, who's a white guy. You have Jimmy Fails, who's a black guy, who really came up up together in the streets of San Francisco together. Mm-hmm. So Joe Talbot is actually the first white guy that I know that has told a black man's story so wonderfully. Mm-hmm. I'm so proud mm-hmm. of the way and impressed with what he's done with this film.
And even the character who's supposed to be sort of like a surrogate for him is cast as black mm-hmm. in the movie. You know, yes, I really just feel like I love the way that he just gives this sort of poetic license to men in the film.
Let me ask y'all this. Mm-hmm. What didn't you like about the film? Because all talk about, what we like. I always, like, what made you uncomfortable or what didn't you like?
Interesting question. Yeah. I don't know that I actually have an answer to it because what I like about this movie
is... Well, you're the white boy in the room. I'm showing you. Come on.
Because this movie to me is my favorite thing, which is it's so acty. Like everybody gets moments to just fully act and it's not about the pretense of like how much music is playing or, you know, it's like, it's poetic, but I'm not, but I literally just get to focus in on... I was saying this in another interview we did. Uh-huh. Actors to me are like landscapes. I like sitting before them and just taking it all in, you know? Uh-huh. And I feel like I get to do that with this movie.
Wonderful. It's not really the movie, but I find it, it's just what made me angry when I leave, which is like, I think of like gentrification and like the way these cities are being changed and erased and the people that sort of created the culture of these places sort of being kicked out. And so it wasn't like, I just leave that like, oh yeah, that sucks.
Like, yeah. But that means this movie did what it was supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? You left angry. And we had a man that came in. He said the same thing. He says, I'm angry. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know what? And now that you have, you're privy to this information, then let's channel that anger. Mm-hmm. Now what do you do with the anger?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because you're leaving differently.
Right.
You know, it's like watching a superhero film. You know, as a kid, you watch Superman. You come out, you think you know, I thought I was Wonder Woman for 20 years. What was your...
Honestly, not just because you're here. I wanted to see more of you in the movie.
Oh wow!
You know, because I wanted to know more.
I like this guy. This guy is going places, y'all. I'm gonna tell you.
No, you know, your scene with Jimmy is just so beautiful. You know, and there's that that scene where you know you're just sort of relating with each other, and then you know he asks for the stuff that I'm not gonna spoil it, but you know it's like. You switch then right into a different mode, and you're like, I knew why you came here, you know? And
a
so
lot of
you
stuff was cut.
Mm-hmm.
So you probably, we should tell Joe to do it like an uncut version. It needs to be an uncut version because the movie is pretty long, but you mm-hmm. stay, it's riveting throughout the whole time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're probably, because he had to cut some things. Mm-hmm. There was some wonderful, even Rob Morgan, he had a moment that, like what made him take the role as Jimmy's father is mm-hmm. because he said, there's one line in it that he says, you know, what you think I had, I wanted your little ass to keep dreaming. I wanted mm-hmm. your little ass to have dreams. Mm-hmm. So that's why I made sure I raised you the way I did.
Yeah, and I mean.
You know, so your ass could keep dreaming, you know, but they took that, it didn't make the film.
Also, I don't know how we have you and Danny Glover in a movie.
I know.
And we got a scene together.
Can you believe, you know, I was so pissed about that scene. And then with the one scene that we're in together, we're on opposite sides of the room. Oh, my, thank this about a bitch.
You know, let's reboot Lethal Weapon. We don't need Mel Gibson no more.
Yeah,
it's you.
I love Mel Gibson. Oh, my God. I love Mel Gibson. But see how you tapped into him and Danny Glover.
Mm-hmm.
That it's kind of the only thing of its kind. And mm-hmm. I think that's what Last Black Man in San Francisco is going to be, the only one and only thing of its kind, mm-hmm. and something that you can always refer to.
Okay, well, the film comes out June 7th.
Yes.
So go and see it.
Please.
Last Black Man in San Francisco.
Yes. There you go.
Kept calling it Last Man in San Francisco.
I forget
that they're black men in San Francisco.
It's a Freudian slip, and that's the whole point of the movie. You forget that there's a whole black culture. And it's so interesting even watching culturally how mm-hmm. everybody is just mixed there. Like, mm-hmm. it's like a melting pot in San Francisco. Yeah. It's crazy.
It is, yes. You tend to think about Oakland, you know, as like mm-hmm. this sort of black area of like the Bay. And I really like this film, and I hope it ushers in more stories about, you know, just sort of black people's history in SF, because we need more of that.
More. And thank you guys for having me.
Thank you. You blessed us.
On the
you
success did. Of your goddamn podcast. I mean, shit. Y'all getting it. You gotta have me back.
Please.
Yes, please. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
When we're back, we'll jump into David Letterman's new revealing interview with Kanye West. Guess who's back in the house? Heels click clack and about.
That's your intro to Kanye West talking to David Letterman.
Last Friday, Kanye sat down with David Letterman to kick off season two of Letterman's Netflix show. My next guest needs no introduction.
I'm not sure that I knew this existed.
It's the kind of thing that makes the news when there's generally a problematic soundbite. Yeah. Do you remember Tina Fey talking to him and him being like, I had no women write on my shows. I wonder why. I never really thought about it before.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But otherwise, I feel like it's getting attention now because of Kanye. And I'm like, is anyone watching any of the other episodes?
Who knows?
I did not. But maybe I will. Because you know what? Before we even get into whatever Kanye West and David Letterman were talking about, I was reminded that he's a very good interviewer.
Oh, yeah. No, you kind of forget that because at the end of The Late Show, he sort of, I don't want to say he seemed checked out, but it was a different show from when he would really like engage with like a wild card guest.
You know, part of the problem I feel like is I don't really think anybody should be interviewing Kanye West anymore.
Right.
Because it's sort of like, what does he really add to the culture or conversation? And we know it's just going to get some crazy soundbite. Like, of course, that's why they booked him. But I did appreciate how we sort of like lulled Kanye into talking about some stuff that he doesn't actually really talk about before, you know, like the beginning, you know, just asking him about, you know, his morning routine and talking about him being a dad and then getting into the stuff about his own dad. You know, I felt like those were interesting things that I would love to hear about if Kanye West weren't who Kanye West has become.
It was interesting because David Letterman asked the questions, like, was crafting the narrative.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't interesting because of anything Kanye was saying.
Of course.
It was just like he was good at interviewing him.
Yeah. And then we, of course, got to... Well, so first they talked about why he stopped taking his medication. And
there was at least a kind of frank discussion of bipolarity. That was kind of interesting.
Of course. Yeah. You know, he attributed a lot of his controversial comments regarding political and social issues to his opinions on mental health and his responsibility to shed thought as an influencer on, you know, basically his bipolar disorder. He said, when you're bipolar, if you don't take medication every day, you have the potential to ramp up and it could take you to a point where you start acting erratic, as TMZ would put it. He made a point of like the, as TMZ would put it, and that was a laugh line in the audience, but I'm also like, sir, you were erratic.
Yeah.
You were saying slavery was a choice and shouting it in the middle of TMZ's bullpen.
I'm glad that at least he's talking about it and that conversation is being had. I would still, as I continue to argue, that doesn't necessarily affect the things you believe in. I believe that it impacts the way that he's behaving, the way that he is communicating it, the decisions he's making to go on these shows and ramble and that kind of thing. I have a hard time just getting to I'm bipolar and that's why I support Trump. And I know that's exactly what he was saying, but that's what people often say about him. Like they sort of brush it away because of that. And I just don't exactly know how you can arrive at that conclusion.
And he also added, like when he talked about being into Trump and talking about how we deserve to have our side of the conversation. It's like, no, don't lull me into believing like there's some like rationale behind this that the rest of us aren't picking up on. It's disgusting that you support him and supported him at the volume that you did.
Right. Yeah. When he said that we don't have to feel the same way, but we have the right to feel what we feel and we have the right to have a conversation about it. That's that annoying devil's advocate thing that he always loves to do, is the fact that he thinks that he's being a disruptor by engaging in this, and then you're always left with the feeling, do you even fucking like Donald Trump? Or are you just doing this because this is who you've decided to be now?
I mean, the crux of it is, like, Donald Trump is an unbelievable egomaniac, as is Kanye West.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's largely what he is identifying in him. And then it's the fact that when there are people are like, hey, that's not a good thing to say. He just doubles on down on it because he believes that he is correct about everything. And because he is an egomaniac and believes that the things he's saying are disruptive or genius or whatever. So like his shit with Trump isn't even that fucking deep. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like he didn't even vote for him, which he admits in the interview.
Which was such a poignant moment when he was talking about his father with Letterman and talking about how his father's like was working on some stuff now and how he wants that to be his legacy. And Kanye was like, well, what about me? Aren't I your legacy? I was like, no, nigga. You are not.
I mean, to believe that the only legacy his father leaves is him is like, tells you a lot.
What did you make of him identifying as like,
Andy Kaufman.
Now, here's the thing. I feel like I've just experienced a lifetime of people describing the genius of Andy Kaufman to me. And I'm not saying there isn't a version of like trolling comedy. If you're not familiar with Andy Kaufman, he's probably most famous for being on the show Taxi. Mm-hmm. Jim Carrey played him in that movie Man on the Moon. But a lot of what he does is basically described as anti-comedy, which is also how I describe Kanye West, generally speaking. But it's also like, I felt like Kanye West was giving himself a lot of credit for a lot of stunts he's pulled in the past, recontextualizing them as somehow like calculated, purposeful comic moves, when in fact they were just serious and out of control and terrible.
Also, like, you were wasted when you interrupted Taylor Swift. Like, truly, there's footage of him walking around with a bottle of Hennessy at the fucking Video Music Awards. Mm-hmm. So the idea that any of this was planned in any way, like, no, man, you were drunk.
I think it's a big revisionist history.
Yes.
And also, yeah, I don't get this whole thing of people always doing this reverence of Andy Kaufman. Is it just because, like, he vanished?
Yeah, maybe. Or whatever? Yeah. He did die at a shockingly young age. He was 35.
Yes, but it was also he, like, pulled away a bit from, like...
Truly, yeah. There's a bit of mystique to him.
Yeah,
yes.
But, you know, I was like... He wasn't even my favorite fucking part of Taxi.
Please.
Okay? Mary Lou Henner,
duh.
Christopher Lloyd, Danny DeVito.
Judd Hirsch, bitch.
Right?
Oscar nominee.
Like, these are people that I love the most. Tony fucking Danza.
Class.
Okay?
Charm.
The better Scott Baio.
Yes. Remember when he was on that show, Hudson something with Lori Loughlin? Anyway. Hudson Street. Okay, yeah.
Lori's probably given him a few calls now.
I know, right?
Please be a character witness. I just don't get it, you know? I mean, I like Sam Rockwell as Andy Kaufman.
This interview, which I think is, you know, when Kanye West is gone and we are looking back on his life and his legacy, I think one of the most defining things about him as an artist and a person will be the loss of his mother. And so anytime he talks about that, which he talked about in the interview, I think it is important because it does, you know, not that it justifies things or whatever, but it is clearly something that fucked him up on a monumental level. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's important to remember. And I think that it's probably something that with a bit of, when we're a bit of distance from it, like you'll really be able to sort of track the impact of that a bit more clearly. And so hearing him discuss that, I'm like, it is a good reminder that this is a person who is, that's something that really
impacted him, broke him,
and like is continuing to have an enormous impact on who he is today.
And I think that, you know, we need that distance, not just from that, but also from his stands, you know?
Yeah.
Like the people who still like feverishly defend anything he does are crazed. and there's this weird moment too where he talks about, and I think this gets to the heart of him wanting to be this disruptor, because he is this egomaniac, and he sees, like, he referenced, there's a funny moment where he quoted a Drake lyric, but
he didn't mention
Drake's name because he said, you know, we had some beef last year. And I don't want to talk about him and his family on this show, which I'm like, fair point, sir.
He probably legally can't talk about Drake and his family anymore.
Aubrey was like, don't mention my family. But he talked about how when he comes out saying other things, people are like, oh, man, you were my avatar. You know, like, I expected you to do this. And I think the problem is that he, like, when he talks about the media and people, like, getting things wrong about him or, like, calling him erratic or whatever and his Trump stuff, no one is ever suggesting that we expected you to do this. You know, like, I'm never like, oh, I need Kanye in my life because he needs to teach me about my life or be this like God to me or whatever. We liked the music. I liked his talent. I liked what he did for hip hop and Black culture at a specific period of time. And then he diverged from that and became detrimental to it. And it wasn't about him not living up to or fulfilling whatever I needed. It was just really about him being a cancer, almost.
Kanye, it's almost a testament to his music. He never had, like, a great personality.
No.
I never found him the person to be that interesting or compelling, but his music was so good that you were just like, we don't need that from you, Kanye. Like, thank you for the new music. You have completely ushered in a new era of hip-hop. Thank you for that. No one really ever wanted to hear what you were talking about.
Thank you for your work on Aphrodisiac, Brandy's best
album. I love that album. I listened to that on the way to Palm Springs.
Listen,
so crazy.
Jay-Z maybe should have stopped with the Black album because Kanye went off on the production on that.
Yes.
That would have been a good ending for everyone.
Where is Estelle?
She was like, if these are the American boys, I'm good. I'm good. I'm good, love, and joy. But other than that, I think that I would like this to be a closing chapter on Kanye, but I know it's not gonna be, you know, like Kim just in the audience smiling the whole time. They still see this as like promo, you know, the moment where he goes to his house, David is at the house. First of all, that haunted fucking house.
Right.
I'm sorry. And they can say that it's like Japanese, like influences all they fucking want. You can talk about Murakami as much as you want, bitch. Like your house looks scary.
It's eerie.
And then I love how the ghost of the house, Chris Jenner, just managed to be there as David Letterman was leaving.
Levitating skull, just holding a candle, Chris Jenner.
Just so she could be on Netflix.
Yeah.
You know what my worry, I mean, like, I would love this to be the last interview for him for a while. My worry is when he is discussing, like, for example, being bipolar and not taking his medication in sort of the context and way that he does, I'm worried that people are going to take that as a valid position and whatever. And I'm like, I don't know that that's what we need to be saying, because this is someone who admittedly needs help. Like a lot of people need, like we all fucking probably need help with something or other. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I just, and because he's doing it in sort of a calm way, it's like, oh, this is more legit. We should listen to what he said. It's like, no, he's still saying things he shouldn't be saying. He's still saying nonsense. He's still saying things that are wrong, but because he's doing it in a more calculated, nuanced way, it's being taken as legitimate. And that's exactly what I don't want to happen.
Right. And we've already like gotten hyperbolic headlines, like Kanye talking about his mental health, like opens the door for us to like talk about bipolar disorder, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, we can already have that conversation.
Without,
we didn't need Kanye to involve himself.
Yeah.
And as he stated, you know, it's been 2 years of his diagnosis, you know? So I'm like, I don't think a celebrity with a lot of money, who has also admitted to like being off of his medication for like 8 months too, is really who we need to be lifting up as a spokesperson for bipolar disorder.
If
like, go interview some actual people who are suffering from this, who aren't like also married to the Kardashian family and like trying to like make themselves God at Sunday service, whatever that is.
If this just turned into a podcast where we analyze celebrity Q&As all day, it would honestly be fulfilling. It is really, really my favorite way to engage with celebrities. Like you said, 8 things, 2 of them were problematic, 1 was amazing, and the other 5, I'm not sure.
I feel like we reach a zenith when we have a podcast where people analyze our Q&As with the celebrities who come
on God.
The show. Oh, God.
I'm, you know, I'm afraid of Reddit.
When we're back, keep it. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. It's Keep It. It's right there on our mugs.
Yeah, it is.
We have Keep It branded mugs now.
Speaking of commercialization.
I was trying to figure out what happened. You both have cold beverages, right? So the condensation, and I was trying to figure out what's happening.
I am drinking a brisk bleep out the name of the product that I'm drinking because they don't pay us. But it tastes very good.
But it's a favorite of a dictator and John Lovett.
Yes, he loves this drink.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and it's not his gross iced coffee drink that he gets from Starbucks.
Oh. I identify as that cold beverage, so be careful.
Anyway, what are we keeping this week?
Shall I start?
I mean, we'll start with you because your keep it is Zany. Another is... Lewis classic.
Lewis brand.
It's Lewis on the balance beam, just tumbling and trying to stay on. And
okay, so
that's why I invented keep it up, bitch.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, I know. No, but I'll get to something mean. Trust me, it gets asinine. Okay, so this is, first of all, my apology that I have not seen Rocket Man yet. Based on not just the reviews, but actual queer persnickety people really being into this movie, I am fucking psyched. It sounds like it is a gay movie.
Well, I haven't seen the fucking movie because I feel like I haven't seen 17 movies.
I know, yes, yeah.
They did some great crossover marketing on Project Runway where designed Elton John-inspired outfits. So
I really got very excited.
Yeah,
okay. Is that season good with Carly?
You know, Carly is irrelevant. The rest of it's still good.
The work still holds
up. She didn't really matter.
Yeah. Okay. You know. Good to hear. So I wanted to make it up for you, come up with an Elton John inspired keep it. And so I went through his career to find one, and here it is. Keep it to the 1994 Academy Award for Best Original Song for Can You Feel the Love Tonight? Guys, that is a garbage single of Elton John's. That is one of his worst songs. And even though we just had Billy Eichner on the show talking about the live action Lion King and how, I guess, Beyonce and Donald Glover sing it? Still waiting for that. All right. That's going to be great. Guys, it's just a creepy song about lions fucking around. I don't know. And then there's like weird lyrics about how a disaster's approaching. It scares me a little bit. And also 1994. Okay, that's a year where the Lion King dominated the music category, so there's three nominations, and they did not even nominate what should have won, Madonna's I'll Remember from With Honors. You know that song?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's in the video, she has black bangs, completely inventing Fairuza Balk and the Craft, which should be very important to you. It's one of her best ballads. And also, I just want to say, it's like Madonna couldn't even get nominated for that. And the year before, we nominated Janet for that song again, which is not in her top 30 either, by the way.
Again is a bop.
I disagree. All Together right. Again is a bop. Again well, is yes. not a bop.
Again is, you know, like a slow, sultry little...
I prefer Runaway if we're talking about those.
Okay. How about this hot take? The only two good best songs were... My Heart Will Go On, and It's Hard Out Here for a Pimp. That is my hot take.
I could have written your answers for that.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised.
Those are the only two good ones.
Are those the only two you remember?
No, I know. I remember Eminem won for Lose Yourself, and he didn't show up.
Look at the sly Oscar expert jumping out.
Yeah, I do remember the year they let Beyonce sing all the songs.
Oh, yeah, she did the song from Phantom of the Opera.
The people who were nominated sing, and they're just like, Beyonce is going to do them all.
Hostile takeover from Miss Knowles, yes.
So that's what I remember. And I actually would have remembered Can't You Feel the Love Tonight.
Yeah, I mean, maybe she'll sing it this year.
Yeah, it could be.
True. This
oh
coming
my
year.
Gosh. Yeah. Wow. But anyway,
that's the only reason we're doing any of this with Lion King, right? Just so we could see her perform it live.
Right. Also, Pride Month exclusive. I just want to point people to an Elton John song with George Michael from the 80s that no one knows about called Wrap Her Up, where they sing this really cokey 80s song, and it concludes with them listing back and forth their favorite female stars out loud. So they're like, Grace Jones, Vivian Lee. It is the gay shit. You need to find this.
Vogue is shook.
No, quite. And it predates Vogue.
My one problem with Rocket Man is that on Fairfax Avenue, there is a Rocket Man installation ad thing. And when you walk by it, music starts playing. And I was walking down the street at night once, and I just started hearing Elton John music, and I was like, what the fuck is happening? I truly couldn't figure out where it's coming from, because it's like this speaker that's kind of hidden, and every time a person walks by, it triggers the music, and I don't love it.
Oh, that's haunting. Was it something loud, too, like Crocodile Rock?
It's kind of loud. Yeah, I don't remember the song, but like you walk by. It just, I'd never seen that with, because it's just a movie, you know, like the movie posters on the walls, and then there's music. It's a bit much, guys.
It's the George Michael song.
Also,
that's why people don't know it.
He's so famous. Like, I know an Elton John song.
Yeah.
Like, I don't need to be reminded when I walk past the poster. Like, he's pretty famous.
Benny and the Jets.
Yeah.
No, I knew that song, by the way.
Oh,
I
did?
Love Lost George Michael duets.
Oh yeah,
the one with talk about
Jody Watley. Learn to Say No.
And If I Told You That.
Oh my God, yes. Well, of course,
just him and Whitney Houston just screaming at each other.
What's the other one that's great with Aretha Franklin? I knew you were waiting for me. That's the best one.
All right, you gave
that's
us
about
a,
it.
Yeah, you gave us a keep it from a lost episode from 1994, Kara. We're just gonna go back right. in time with our keep it now. Keep it to AIDS.
Okay. My keep it is to the Keanu Reeves slander that I am seeing on my timeline.
Meaning what?
Well, who was slandering Keanu Reeves?
Here's what's happening. Keanu Reeves is back in the zeitgeist. You know, he has the John Wick movie. He has an excellent turn in Always Be My Maybe on Netflix. And people are like, you know what? He's like not that hot. Or, which I feel like what happens with Keanu Reeves is they're like, he's not a good actor. He just is, you know, he's just playing like action heroes with no emotions or whatever. Keanu Reeves is an excellent actor. Those are creative decisions that he is making. He is hilarious in Always Be My Maybe.
So many creative decisions and Much Ado About Nothing.
So,
that he
yes.
was making.
Give me,
listen. And I stand, Keanu.
Listen, if we had Betty Draper truly not changing her facial expression for the entirety of Mad Men, you guys can watch Keanu Reeves do what he does best. He's also like 50 years old. He looks great. His hair is immaculate. And you all need to just be happy. He's even blessing us with anything else. John Wick 3. I haven't seen any of the John Wicks, but I assume you all liked them.
Pair of Ben Bellum.
Yeah, sure. Is that his name in the movie?
The third installment's called Parabellum.
Got it. Listen, he did all that training. He had to go do the... I saw the video of him and Halle Berry, and they're shooting the guns, and they're in the gym, and they're doing all that shit, just so you can get a John Wick 3. Just be happy.
It does feel to me like Twitter has discovered in a major way, though, that he seems like a wonderful person. Like, just like
yes.
he's quoted a lot when he was on Colbert and said that, like, Colbert's like, what do you think happens when we die? And he literally goes, the people who love us will miss us.
Yeah.
Whoa, are you Jesus?
Exactly.
Also, that narrative about him being a bad actor is such an age-old take. It's from when he was in even Dangerous Liaisons or something. It's like years and years and years old.
Speed? Hello?
Fabulous.
Great movie. Acting his face off in that movie.
Listen, he is from the school of acting where it's all about the director and the script and the vibe. I think Hitchcock would have loved Keanu.
Oh,
because he would not
you
have been trouble
exactly
on
right.
set.
You are
also,
exactly right.
There was a infographic going around or like a list of male action, not even just action stars, but like male box office stars who'd worked with female directors. And if you can believe it, very few of them had worked with like more than one or two.
Gasp.
And he, right, if you can believe it. And he had worked with like significantly more female directors mm-hmm. than all of these dudes.
His breakout with one of my faves, Catherine Bigelow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Point Break is truly that movie.
And Ninochka Khan did this Always Be My Maybe. So
mm-hmm.
leave him alone, guys.
And he gets points in retrospect for the Matrix movies.
Sure. Oh, does he?
Why yeah. in re-
Well, because it's on the list of female directors that
oh,
he's
right.
worked
right.
with.
Right, right, right. Yes,
yeah,
yes.
It includes them, which he didn't know at the time, but it counts.
And his hair remains fabulous. He has the hair of like Ann Curry or something.
He has
yes,
great
he
hair.
Does have the hair of Ann Curry.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yes.
It's a beautiful.
Let him read the news to us.
Please.
Fuck Megyn Kelly.
Actually, if Aaron Curry, I bet she can't act, though I love her.
I love her too.
If I could do like an Aaron Curry, Keanu Reeves rom-com,
oof.
Mm.
I would watch the shit out of that.
Okay.
And you can do it, girl.
I'd watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah. What are they doing in this rom-com?
I mean, my first instinct is that they're morning news anchors.
Right,
yeah.
Just so she doesn't have to stretch too far.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, they fall in love on air. They're like those two psychos on MSNBC. What are their names?
From Morning Joe?
Morning Joe.
Joe and...
and whatever
Micah
her name is.
Versus.
Micah,
Joe and Micah?
Yeah.
The only Micah I like is the gay pop singer that we didn't appreciate enough.
We didn't. That song, Grace Kelly, so good.
I know. He could have been singing the songs in Call Me By Your Name.
Right.
Yeah. Instead
oh, my
got
God.
That,
what could have been?
That maybe gay Jesus lover.
good voice, though.
Yeah. He's got a great voice. So my keep it this week, you know, there's a lot of things I could keep.
There was a lot.
I could say... I could keep it to Showtime and Jason Mitchell, just on a set harassing people. I could keep it to, as much as I love her, a bad statement from Lena Waithe where she was just like, I feel bad for Tiffany Boone. I was like, all right, girl. I want a little bit more than that. But my actual keep it this week is to people online praising the Queen of England.
I mean, she's good at it. I don't know.
So
Americans, I just want to be clear.
No, even British people, too. So I saw this on Twitter late last night as I was doing, you know, research.
Macrame.
Yeah. I know you're going to say.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so the fucking Trump family is in England for some reason.
Ivanka's looking a mess, by the way. That awful dress.
First of all, she looks a mess. None of the Trump sons look good in their tuxes. Like, their tailor was either asleep or sabotaging them.
They truly looked like they were in a community theater production of Showboat. Gross. Yeah.
Listen, I love Showboat.
I'm not human. I love Edna Ferber. Please.
It also looks like they gave Tiffany one of Ivanka's old dresses that didn't quite fit her. And they were like, squeeze in, girl, bitch. We forgot you were coming.
The corset looked tight.
Yeah.
She looks like she was trying to either breathe or do the Olsen twins moment during all the photos. She looked uncomfortable. Maybe it's because she's not used to being in photos with her family.
Yes. The vibe was very like Six Flags photo booth.
Yeah. But anyway, the Trumps are there at the White House. The red carpet is being rolled out, whatever. People online keep trying to interpret things that the Queen is doing as quote unquote shade against Trump. Mm-hmm. She gave him a book. Oh my God, expert shade from the Queen because they know that Trump can't read. Bitch, she is not shading him by giving him a book. It was lying around the house.
Also, do you think that was her decision? So the Queen walked out. Someone was like, here, bitch, give this to him. She didn't even know what it was. Like, she was out here selecting a book, wrapping it herself. She doesn't know what's happening.
Someone tried to say that the crown that she was wearing, like the jewel symbol repelling hate, and she was doing that to repel Trump. Come on. They invited him to the fucking house. Philip is up in there, you know, being a Nazi. So I really don't think that they're that pressed about Donald Trump. They may not like him, but they're not doing these like expert clues to send through the media. The only person there who actually treated Trump as they should have was Harry.
What do you do?
Well, Harry just sort of like the British press, which is trash, was sort of dragging him. He was being dragged in the sun for having bad manners because he apparently only showed up for the introductory sort of meal with Trump, and then he peaced out.
Why would he show up to some shit? That fucking buffoon just called his wife nasty.
They were like, bad manners. He should have been on the rest of the whole thing with Trump. And of course they think it's bad manners from him because they don't like Meghan Markle.
Right.
They're like, oh, he should disrespect her.
Right.
And also, William shouldn't have been there in the first place either. Because you remember when Trump on Howard Stern was talking about he could have fucked Diana, but like she would have had to take like
I should have taken out the whole family.
She would have had to take like an STD test before because she did all her work with AIDS.
Mm.
Oh, you know, my least favorite sort of narrative around all that was like when they would do a side by side of a picture of the Queen with Barack Obama and her face and then a picture of her with Trump. And I was like, she looks the same. They're like, oh, she just look at her face. I'm like, her stoic, emotionless face that she's had for 55 years, as if there was any difference between them. She was just standing there each time, guys. She's so old. She just shows up. She stands there with her little handbag. She's wearing the crown. She takes the pictures. That's it. It looks no different.
I'm still getting over you saying someone handed her a book and said, here, bitch.
I don't know. What, like a lady in waiting? Do they still have? Is that what they still have?
It could have been the Devil Wears Prada. They grabbed the first book on that shelf.
Because they know he's not going to read it.
E, pray, love.
It sure doesn't matter.
But yeah. You know who did give a little like wink to the camera, like fuck this, was Camilla Parker Bowles. Did you see that?
Yeah.
It was kind of funny.
Or maybe her wink was to Melania because they were both mistresses who
right.
turned themselves into wives.
Zapped themselves into power.
They're like, I get you, girl. We're desperate housewives.
Well, the other thing is the actual like good pushback to Trump was all of the shit around England. They had like someone had shaved like a dick into like a field with his name.
Was projecting Obama's approval ratings on the side of the palace.
Yeah, like the actual citizens had done all of this shit around the city to just be like, fuck you, Trump, we hate you.
Oh, and someone put up an image of like John McCain's.
Like his hat. His hat.
Oh, right.
Like
yes.
That
was on Madame Tussauds. Yeah. We need more creative trolling here in that.
Right,
way.
But that was great. So I don't know why you are, I don't know why you need to focus on these boring old inbred white people as if they are throwing him any shade whatsoever.
Yeah. The queen doesn't know what shade is.
No. Please.
She knows what shade her servants are.
Jesus.
They're probably a lot lighter than they used to be just because of optics, you know?
Oh my God. She looks good in lime.
She does look good in lime. You know what? The crowd has made me like the queen. It's just she wasn't doing anything.
The crowd has made me like Claire Foy. I mean, I don't know if I care that much more about the queen herself.
I don't know that I care, but I appreciate how long she has been doing this shit.
Of course. Well, if she will give some of her diet regimen to, or live it regimen to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I'd very much appreciate it if Ruth Bader
Ginsburg better be sitting on an HGH needle right now.
If she can live as long as this happened, then I am for it.
Woo.
I think that's our show.
Yeah.
Wow. Well,
you started a war with the United Kingdom, so we're ready to go now.
Follow up on Twitter with that one.
Pod Save the Crown will be coming after us, our rival British podcast. cheerio! Thanks to Jacob Tobia and to Tina Arnold for joining us today. We will see you next week.